Coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic. This is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Borag Thunga, thlitz and welcome to the second part of our interview with artist Arthur Ranson. If you've not listened to this episode, please go back and listen to episode one. It's been absolutely fascinating so far, so I hope you're strapped in and ready for more in the second episode. Just some quick housekeeping before we crack on. If you listen to this in the week of release, then this weekend we have a very special signing in London at Forbidden Planet with both Simon Bisley and Cam Kennedy, who are going to be signing copies of the new Batman Judge Dredd Digest Edition. That's a combination of Judgment on Gotham and Vendetta in Gotham, which, lovely little book, great signing. Make sure you come along and, get a copy signed by two of the all-time greats of 2000 AD. I'm talking about signings. First weekend in May is Free Comic Book Day, when we're going to be having a super signing at Orbital Comics, also in London, with some of the creators behind our All Ages Free Comic Book Day issue this year. So make sure you don't miss that one. Earthlit should be a great day. And if you enjoy this two-part interview, please do go along to iTunes and the podcast app of your choice and leave us a little rating. It always makes a difference to know that people are listening and enjoying the podcast. So please do let us know what you think. If you want to email us, we're on Thrillcast, all one word, at 2000ad.com. That's Thrillcast at 2000ad.com. But without much further ado, let's hear more from Arthur Ranson. I want to come back to talking about Anderson and the way that you portray her, which has changed over the last sort of 20 odd years.
Yeah, she aged, didn't she?
Yeah, she's aged. And this is one of the curious byproducts of the way that Judge Dredd and his world have been portrayed and published in the ages in real time. And so therefore Anderson ages in real time as well. Do you want to explain a little bit about your feelings towards that and the ways in which you've represented Anderson growing older?
Yeah. I think that was funny because I thought it was a really nice idea. Mm. But and I know people wrote in and complained about Anderson looking so much older. But in fact, I made very little change to her at all. I changed her hairstyle. I think that's about all changed.
Right.
But I was thinking of her as an old, looking as being older. And so she looked older.
Right.
But I didn't actually try to draw a 50-year-old woman. I suspect if you took out the faces from Anderson at 50 and compared them to the drawings of Anderson at 20, wherever she was when I started, there wouldn't be any difference. It's just the people's perception always. I mean, my perception of when I was drawing her was different, and I think that this comes over. But I didn't consciously make any changes at all, apart from a hairstyle.
Do you think that says a lot about the way people think about women and female characters?
I guess. I do object quite a lot to how women are presented in comics.
Because you've got the Half-Life sort of epic. I mean, that was a long story, the whole WMD and Half-Life thing. And she goes through an awful lot and ends up with that sort of bob that she has. And Alan puts references in the script to her getting older. So do you think it is just, I mean, is that the power of not necessarily comics, but art, but like one change and all of a sudden people's perception of a character is completely different? You know, it just changed the way that...
I mean, people don't come to a comic or anything else without a lot of preconceptions of their own. They're carrying all their own stuff, which they attach to what they're looking at.
Because you've described Anderson as being a character with strength and vulnerability at the same time. Again, are those just qualities that you hold in your mind while you're drawing and they kind of
come out the other end? Or are there things that you've specifically done?
I just feel as now I know who she is. So when I'm drawing her, I feel, you know, I know this person and this is what she's feeling or doing or being at this moment. And it's what's going on in my head. I mean, perhaps it affects the way I draw it, but it's difficult to know because if any particular picture is presented in a different context, people will probably read it completely differently anyway. So I'm not sure that it's kind of intrinsic to the image. It's part of this continuum of the story.
Because one of the things I wanted to talk about was we've already discussed how you make a world real. You fill it with things that fit, with things that look real. And I was always particularly struck in Shambhala by two things, one very mundane and one a bit more technical. The quality of your walls. The way you render walls always struck me as being very solid. And it's weird. It's weird that that's something you notice. I mean, very much, I was a teenager when I was reading this. So, you know, she walks into the Centre for Fortean Studies or whatever it is. And you know, the windows have frames and those frames look like they're properly bolted into the wall. And, you know, there's a certain degree of grounding. And then when they're travelling to Nepal, and the Deros attack, and the train goes off the track, and you've got this remarkable rendering of a Soviet-era train. I mean, that's kind of, coming back to the point, that's kind of above and beyond the call of duty almost, you know? I mean, because that's the most detailed thing on that page, because there's, you know, nice big sort of wide panels.
I had just recently come back from Russia and taken some pictures of Russian trains.
So you just felt like putting a very detailed Russian train into the story. One of the reasons why I wanted to touch on this was because that's around about the time that Alan begins to bring in a lot of the kind of mysticism and esotericism and Fortiana and the magical as well. And when you have a very grounded style like yours, one that is about making things seem real within their context, introducing supernatural elements into a natural setting is going to be quite a challenge. So how did you balance those two things?
You make it sound so much harder than I thought.
Well, maybe this is just me reading this stuff, you know. And I kind of look at it and go, wow, that's amazing. But your reaction suggests that you just got on with it.
It's just the same problem. I mean, when you need a Russian train going over a cliff, you try to make it look real. And if you're, you know, an angel appearing, you try to make that look as convincing as well. It doesn't seem to be any contradiction. Or at least it wasn't a problem to me. I didn't. It didn't trouble me to do that.
Because it's interesting that your time with Alan is the period when those elements in Anderson's story get larger, you know. So you have Shambhala, you've got Satan, you have something like the Jesus syndrome, and then all the way through to Half-Life. And even when you're drawing Satan himself walking on the battlements of the West Wall, he looks solid, he looks real. I mean, is that a benefit of having done so many things before? You know, when you're drawing Sapphire and Steel, when you're drawing Wurzel Gummidge, when you're drawing Danger Mouse, you're used to being able to render whatever needs to be rendered in a solid way that fits.
I That doesn't really sound like a question. Yes. What can I say? I mean, it's just it's the same job,
yeah,
all the time. I mean, the Jesus story, the Jesus syndrome.
Yeah,
wasn't that a strange story? It was just so strange. Why would a comic writer, for a science fiction comic, write a story? It's just wonderful. It's really nice.
Well, it's the contrast again. You know, you have this science fiction story, and it's touching on themes of faith and hope and religion, and you know, you did that amazing page of when she's in Baptiste's head of Christ on the cross, and you know, it again, we're coming back to the symbology about using images that mean an awful lot, yeah, beyond their face value, kind of thing. Was it odd? Did you find it odd? Did you read the script and think, this is a bit weird?
No, I just thought, this. I like this. I'm looking forward to drawing this.
Right.
It not occurred to me until now to question why Alan would think to write it. Because it's an extraordinary thing to appear, isn't it?
Yeah.
In a science fiction beat-em-up kind of comic.
It is. I mean, but this is why things like Cryo Chambala, Jesus Syndrome, etc., some of my favourite comics, because they're asking big questions. They're touching on big, you know, whether they answer those questions or not is kind of irrelevant. But yeah, to read something and go, wow, that's reaching, even if it doesn't grasp, yeah, kind of thing.
Alan should get a knighthood.
No argument from me, both him and John. Let's just touch on that relationship, because you've worked with John Wagner and you've worked with Alan, and hang on, let me, what was the phrase you used? Mythic and non-mythic. So you've described John.
Is that what I said?
Yeah, you described John as being, his writing style is non-mythic, Alan is mythic.
John, apart from his humorous things, John is big, down to earth, no nonsense kind of writer, it seems to me. I mean, stuff happens and it's all real and concrete and stuff. Yeah.
Whereas
Alan's is the opposite. You know, yeah. I mean, his head's all over the place in faraway places. And if, you know, I mean, John, for a writer, is a man of few words. He doesn't.
He's pretty taciturn, isn't he?
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. But in his scripts too. You know, it just says this happens, and that's it. There's no attempt to give you a psychological background or explanation or anything like that.
Without wishing to play favourites, which is your favourite?
What, between the two of them?
Between the two of them, because you've done fairly substantial work with them both. What has been the most rewarding experience of the two?
Yeah, no, without suggesting anyway which is the better, the stuff that I've done with Alan probably suits my outlook better.
Right. Why?
And
well, just why is there a particular reason? Well,
I mean, because Anna and I shared a lot of interest and outlook and, you know, concern about stuff which I don't know. I'm not going to say John's not interested in, but I've never heard any idea from John about any of that kind of stuff.
I mean, maybe it comes down to what we were just talking about theme. I suppose actually the way you describe it, mythic and non-mythic, is probably accurate.
Yeah.
And
then in those terms, I guess I've got a slight preference for the mythic stuff.
we're talking about the Mythic, then let's talk about Maze World, which we're bringing out a new edition of later this year.
Oh, well done.
Thank you. It'd be good to get back in
the Dutch are doing one.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Am I right thinking you came up with a big backstory for the Maze World religion and...
Apparently.
Yeah. Do you not remember this?
I don't remember doing that.
Wow, okay.
Well, I mean, it wasn't uncommon for me to share ideas with writers. So, I mean, it wouldn't have been particularly memorable if I had done that.
The reason I ask is because one of the things that strikes me about Maze World is just how rich that world is. Beyond the obvious straightforward artistic representation of it, because you know you're drawing in all those influences and images, there just seems so much detail there that isn't necessarily explicit. I wanted to kind of know where the how much was in the script and how much was you piling stuff in.
The drawing of Maze World that went on the cover, you know, the entire world, I did that before Alan had given me a script, I think, right. Just the idea. I thought if... Alan suggested this idea of a world made up of mazes. And I thought, if we're going to draw a comic based on that, we need to know where the hell it's set and what it looks like. So I thought for my own sake, I need to draw the whole thing so I'd know where everybody was, when they needed to be there, and what it looked like when they got there. So I did that before there was much of a script. And in fact, I think Anna has said that when he saw that drawing, that gave him that was a help for him to write the script. So what was the question?
Well, it was how much of Maze World is in the script and how much is you running with the theme?
Well, the appearance of it would have been entirely mine. I mean, if I invented their religion, that's possible, but I don't recall suggesting anything else.
Right.
Or putting anything else in.
Okay. Because, I mean, this was an out-and-out fantastical strip. This was straightforward fantasy.
Yeah, this was my idea of what a European comic should look like.
Right.
that was before it started, but that was what I had in mind when I talked to Alan about it. And I'm really pleased with it because although it ran reasonably successfully in 2008, it seemed to have been, you know, everyone said, well, that's that, and it was forgotten. And I'm really pleased that it's making a comeback because I think it deserves it. You jump.
Scared the life out of me. Because there was a campaign, wasn't there?
Well, of sorts. I mean, if someone left a comment on the website to say that what's happened to Maze World and why don't they reprint it? Yeah. And I said, well, start a movement, which he did. He didn't get an enormous following, but someone at 2000 AD must have seen it because... shortly after that, they did a reprint. And let me think, there's been one reprint?
There's been one reprint, and then we're doing it again.
It's going to be another reprint, and the Dutch are doing doing the three parts. Anybody else? No, that's it.
I don't think at the moment, no.
No. But I'm glad to see it. It's making a comeback.
Because there was a Calibre... black and white reprint back in the day, wasn't there?
Harvey Counts. Yeah, they did a black and white thing.
That seems bizarre.
If anybody read it, I'd be surprised. Calibre, didn't they go bust immediately afterwards? Yeah.
with someone like Maze World, I mean, we've kind of touched on it already, but there's... I wanted to ask about the kind of grounding the fantastical, because again, you're dealing with a fantasy world that doesn't necessarily follow the rules of the real world. You know, it's a world floating in clouds that's made out of mazes, and there's magic and, you know, flying animals and all sorts. So was this an opportunity for your imagination to go wild?
It was an opportunity to prove that I didn't need a reference for everything I drew. It's just something I could imply.
Right. I mean, you say that the you were pleased with it. Has it stood up in? Has it sort of stood up in a reread?
I mean, looking at it recently, I mean, it's funny about work. I mean. I do stuff, and I think that's okay. That'll do. And then sometime later you see it, and you think that's really not good enough. And then, but sometimes you see stuff and you think, oh, it's really quite good. Yeah. Oh, it's good. I'm quite pleased with that. Maze World is now at that stage where I'm looking at it and thinking, oh, that's not a bad job of work at all. Whereas, you know, I don't feel bad about it.
Right.
Which I mean, I can do about my work. I see stuff and think that's pretty awful. But all these parts of it are awful.
Mm.
But no, Maze World's in my good books at the moment.
Because based on what you've said, it sounds, in terms of its genesis, not necessarily more collaborative, but it's you and Alan swapping ideas and images.
I did that with all my writers.
Right.
All my writers, all three, there's only three of them, basically. But yeah, no, I always felt free to tell people what I thought. I mean, John Wagner gave up eventually, because I used to ask him, I said, can I do this?
Yeah.
And he'd have to say yes or no. But he gave up after a while, and he just said, if you do it, whatever it is. You know. So, I mean, yeah, a lot of Button Man, the images are, you know, not from the script, but something I invented.
Mm. Let's talk about Button Man, because it's an oddity in 2000 AD in lots of ways. Number one, it's a straightforward crime comic. There's no science fiction elements at all. Number two, it's creator-owned. So you and John own it. Do you want to explain a little bit about how it ended up in 2000 AD?
Well, really no idea.
Oh, really?
I mean, it was done for some failed comic initially. The only reason it went to 2000 AD, I imagine, is because John Wagner was connected to it.
Right.
I suppose that he went to them and said, look, we've got this, and they thought, well, because it's John Wagner, we'll do it.
Right.
But I never heard the story. I never talked to John about how it happened.
Were there any particular influences that you brought to Button Man? Because, it's a bit like when we were talking about Triad, it's sewn... noir, you know, it almost reads like a storyboard for a movie. were there particular influences from movies that you bought in?
Not that I recall. I mean, my concern with it, and the reason I'd be adding frames and sequences is to make it easily readable, make it kind of flow.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like, is this happening? And a few seconds later, this is happening. I want it to sort of go like that. I mean, comics do that a lot. They show you a scene and they show you the and the next frame doesn't actually follow on. It's like watching a movie with half a dozen frames cut out of it. Right. So it's that sort of jumps. And that drives me nuts in comics. I like it when you're not aware that there's any kind of break. It just kind of flows through. Unless there's a break like you're saying, well, that's where this ends and there this starts. Mm. But when there's a sequence going on, it should flow. So that was the kind of thing that I was suggesting to Alan, to fill in stuff. There's the sequence that there's quite a lot of fuss about. Where Harry's on the telephone in the garden, and I drew a sequence about a badger and a snake, and the badger kills the snake, and it covers a page and a half, I think. The reason for that was because in the script I had, Harry was talking for a page and a half, and I thought, fuck that, I thought. I'm not drawing a page and a half of a man on a telephone. So I thought, we'll do this. I mean, it's something that could be happening at that time, and it's all kind of symbolic, right? Mm. there's the, the badger hero overcoming the evil snake. And there was a lot of fuss. I mean, somebody wrote and said a pretentious John Wagner was for writing such a sequence. So I had to confess it was all my fault. But it doesn't work anyway, because afterwards John edited it and took out all the dialogue that was supposed to fill up all these pages. So it doesn't really work as it was intended to.
One of the things that really strikes me in Buckman is the contrast between silence and action, or stillness and action. That's probably a better way of describing it. So coming back to what you were saying about inserting panels to connect up action sequences, there's a lot of moments of stillness and pause. And it's quite remarkable in that it seems to almost heighten the action, because you have the quiet, you have, even when something is happening, you have somebody running, but they're running in silence. There's no sound effects. In fact, I think the only sound effects you have in Button Man are when people are shooting or when there's a vehicle being used. Everything else is just kind of implicit in the image. In terms of your storytelling, how important is it to have that contrast between stillness and action?
Yeah, no, you're doing it again.
Sorry.
You asked me to explain something which I've never given a thought to.
Oh, okay.
And if I would, I mean, if it happens in the work, it just happens because that's what was going on at the time.
Right.
It's not something I think, oh, we should do this.
Yeah.
Because it'll make it work better. If I thought we need a quiet place here, it would happen at that moment, reading the script and thinking, well, we've got to get from here to here, what do we need?
Yeah.
But it wouldn't be any kind of conscious literary construction of story kind of thing.
But you see, that's what I find so fascinating about that process is that it's innate. You kind of do it out of skill.
Yeah, well,
out of experience.
Well, yeah. I mean, you read a lot of comics, you read a lot of books, you see a lot of movies.
Yeah.
I mean, you get some idea how these things work, how stories should proceed, and then apply it when it's your job to tell the story.
Because that's why I asked about influences on Button Man.
Yeah, well, in a lifetime of watching movies and reading crime thrillers.
Right.
It's not a question of, oh, look, there's some artist who does this and so I'll do it.
Yeah.
No, it's not like, I mean, it does amaze me sometimes how bad some comic people are at telling stories.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just they don't read, I don't know, they don't read enough. And writers too. Jesus, I had some scripts from American writers.
Yeah.
Who, if they ever read a comic in their life, I'd be surprised. What they do is watch television.
Right.
and you get what is a description of watching a television program. Terrible.
Because as we said, John Wagner's famously taciturn with his panel descriptions, yes. Which leave you an awful lot of leeway to do what you want. But
yeah, I mean, John constructs is a good word. I mean, it's this kind of architecture of how the story works, what happens, the physicality of it. So then you try to illustrate. You start to recreate that.
Mm. I suppose, again, that's something that comes from experience. Number one, his experience of 40-odd years of writing comics, and your experience of drawing comics, and the story comes out as some kind of synthesis of those two things.
Yeah, I mean, the story, the important thing about comic is the story. I mean, it's not the costume or the muscles or the boobs or whatever, the heroine or hero.
You've mentioned making a slight change to the end of book one.
Oh, yeah.
what was it originally going to be, and how did you change it?
Oh, we can tell this now, can't we? Harry died.
Right.
Harry was dead. With the script I got, Harry died on the doorstep of the psychiatrist. And I thought, sod that, this could do another story. So instead of drawing a dead Harry, I drew an ambulance.
Right.
So you can draw your own conclusions. Then it was up to John whether he wanted to pick it up or not.
Did you get any feedback from John about that? Or was it just the scripts for Button Man 2 turned up?
He's never mentioned it.
Because the second and third series kind of transplant the action to America.
Yeah.
And the way that... The way the kind of structure of the story seems to change to a certain extent in terms of your artwork is the pages almost get bigger. There's a lot more kind of single page panels and big panels, particularly when he's attacking the compound in the swamp, where you get things like the alligators and the helicopter being downed. It seems like you were having a lot of fun with that.
Yes, no, yeah. I enjoyed the alligators and the Florida swamp.
Mm.
Drawing that, I mean, it was just a lot of interesting stuff to draw.
I know the story behind this, but if you want to explain why were you unable to draw the Hitman's Daughter, the fourth book?
Well, John suggests doing a fourth one. Fine, what are we going to do? Apparently, it was my idea to have a daughter of a dead Batman man. Mm. But then, when John started sending bits of scripts, and I wasn't very keen on them. I mean, for a start, he had Harry working for a drug dealer, and I thought, Harry can't do that. I mean, he's a villain or a murderer, but he's not a drug dealer. I thought that was kind of beneath him.
Right.
You know, he didn't seem that sort of man to me. So I was kind of uncomfortable with that. And there's some other things in the script which I weren't terribly happy about or sympathetic with. And then I got an offer to draw some superhero for an American comic. That was what I was planning to do. Mm. Then I got cancer, so I didn't draw anything for the next couple of years.
Forgive me for delving into that a little bit. I mean, was this something that was going to be curable, or you know, at the time, did you know it was going to be okay, or
well, I was kind of told that I would survive.
Mm.
Although, I mean, how long ago was it? 13 years ago, or something like that.
Mm.
And subsequently, two doctors have told me why they thought it was a good idea to tell me. But two separate doctors have told me that the life expectancy of the operation I had is 6 years. So why would anybody tell you that? It's a strange thing to do. But anyway, 13 years, so I guess I'll touch wood.
Did that change your perspective on things at all?
Oh, yeah, I retired,
didn't I? Well, there you go.
I mean, not immediately, but, yeah. I mean, instead of... I did think I was going to go back to work. But then when I started doing it, I thought, I don't want to do this. I don't want to spend all day sitting at a desk.
Mm.
So I went off to play instead.
And in terms
and
of...
it's done, retiring is done, yeah. One of the best... career moves I ever made.
Oh, really?
I got far more attention once I'd retired than when I was working.
Well, you've kind of cut the flow at source, really, haven't you, in terms of artwork? How are you spending your retirement? Because you paint now, don't you?
I do. I mean, I did that. What I was thinking of. I did that ridiculous story on my website.
Right.
The, where was it called?
Serious.
Right. I did that. That took me God knows how long. I don't know what I've been doing. There was, the last month or two I was spending redesigning Elvis story.
Mm-hmm.
So that works.
I mean, you've kind of already answered this, but have you ever been tempted to go back to comics?
No. Mm-hmm. No, I just couldn't face the discipline anymore.
Mm.
I mean, not that it didn't seem hard at the time, but it wouldn't now. And also, I've got more bloody-minded. I'm not interested in pleasing anybody.
Surely that's a good thing. Surely that's a good thing.
Well, it is for me, yeah.
There's a couple of things that I want to just click back on. Because you, despite the fact that you started in 2008 in the 1980s, you weren't part of the so-called British invasions that went over to America. But you did do... some American work. You did Batman, The Legends of the Dark Knight, Tau with Alan Grant when he was working on that, which is, again, something that Zainab Akhtar in her blog has really sort of drilled down into. One of the things that she touches on is how you make a superhero in a rubber bat suit seem comfortable in a real environment, while at the same time in a story like Tau have these kind of fantastical designs and double page spreads that are kind of Batman on one side with the design behind him and a martial artist on the other page with a big design behind him. I imagine that most American comic book readers didn't know what hit them.
I have no idea what they thought. I had one. The only comment I was aware of was someone that said Arthur Anson is God, and I thought not really. But apart from him, I think he must have been the only one in America that really really liked what I did, because I didn't like what I did very much.
Right. So, why not? What was it?
Well, I'm just not a superhero kind of artist, I don't think. I've enjoyed drawing Batman, but when he's a kind of mystery figure, but when he actually gets into action and get involved with other people, it's all I don't want to draw it. I guess it's the truth.
Because it's interesting how many...
Let me say this. The Phantom Stranger and Batman, that should have been amazing.
Yeah.
But DC said no spooky stuff, they said.
Okay.
Let's do a Phantom Stranger story with no spooky stuff. For Christ's sake, what were they thinking? So Alan was on to, you know, absolutely no win, hiding to nothing with that.
Did you have any desire to do more stuff?
Nah.
For America?
I would have quite liked to have done the one I was supposed to do, what was his name? The Punisher.
Oh.
Was it The Punisher?
Wait, you on The Punisher?
No.
The guy with the big skull on his thing.
No, not The Punisher. What's his name? He's got a big helmet. He's blue.
Ronan the Accuser.
That's the one.
Ah, right. Okay. So, right.
That would have been a fun to draw back, I thought. I mean, he was a B-list superhero that they were thinking of reviving. So I was redesigning his outfit.
Yeah.
And then imagined him doing lots of science fiction-y stuff, flying around different planets, boffing people. But it wasn't to be. But I would quite enjoy doing that.
Because he was the villain in the Guardians of the Galaxy movie. The first.
I think he's had a mixed sort of career.
Yeah. I mean, if say you'd...
And they didn't use my designs in the end either. I mean, he was redesigned, but not as good as I did.
Right. If you'd been given the opportunity to draw Captain Marvel, for example.
No.
Despite your sort of childhood love.
It would be blasphemous to try to compete with C.C. Beck.
Right. One of the things I did want to pick up on was the issue of creators' rights, because we've talked about credit boxes and things like that. Buttman creator-owned, but surprisingly, certainly from my point of view, was the Beatles and the Elvis stuff that you did for Looking being creator-owned. Now, for a comic that didn't even allow credit boxes for his artists, this is quite something. How did that come about?
Well, it was... what's his name? Neil, the American...
Neil Adams
was in London and came to an SSI meeting and was talking about artist rights and stuff like that.
Mm.
When Colin asked Angus and I to do the Elvis story initially, I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to get tired to doing pop stars.
Mm.
I would sooner be doing some adventure stuff. So in order to put a stop to it, I said, well, I'll do it, but only if I get creators' rights. And much to my surprise, and Angus made Angus very nervous, Colin said yes.
Fine.
So, of course, once we'd done that, when the Beatles came up, we asked for the same terms. And it's turned out... the Beatles story, was a good move.
Mm.
Elvis so far has bought me absolutely nothing. And of course, when we had artist rights, we took a cut in the pay. Which with Elvis, I haven't recovered yet.
I mean, there is something you say on your blog about how when you made the shift from Looking to 2000 AD, it took you a few years before you were earning as much as you had been doing on Looking. I mean, was Looking a particularly well...
Looking paid huge amounts.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. I mean, compared to everybody else. Let me think. I mean, this was in the 80s. It was £250 a page.
That's not bad for the 80s. But, I mean, it kind of plugs into what you were saying about it being... one of the best-selling titles out there.
Yeah.
Because it's fascinating that as an anthology, Lookin handled so many different licenses. Because you look at what Marvel UK did in the 1980s, and they had one comic per license. So you had a Transformers comic, you had a G.I. Joe comic. I don't think Zoids ever got their own comic, but nonetheless, people were doing comics of them. But then with Lookin, from the 70s until the very late 80s, they were properly kind of plugging into every new little zeitgeist that came along.
Yeah, they were a remarkable team.
Because was Colin your editor throughout your time there, or did he move on?
No, there's somebody before him whose name I won't be able to recall. But mostly it was, but not for long.
Right.
I mean, it was Colin most of the time. Mm. And it was Colin that gave me the... Colin was art editor, so he gave me my first job there.
Right. That's for any editor on any publication, that's a very long run to be on something for. Do you feel lucky that...
Not that hard. Lots of I've been really lucky. Mm. First of all, that Colin gave me the job in the first place. That he must have seen something which nobody else would have done.
Yeah.
I mean, he let me get away with that role. So I was lucky with him. Also been really lucky with writers. Mm. I mean, Angus Allen, Alan Grant, and John Wagner. So no rubbish.
Mm.
I've been really lucky.
So, I mean, you were a going way back to sort of before you were in comics, you were a teacher for a time, weren't you?
Yeah, in Dagenham.
Right, okay. How long did that last?
2 years, I think.
Right, okay.
2 or 3 years. The second year, I absolutely loved it.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, it was a pretty tough school.
Yeah.
I remember it being described as the second toughest school in Dagenham.
Wow.
The first year was really hard. Mm. I mean, a bunch of fifth formers were a little struggle to get on with. But the second year, got a whole new bunch of kids coming. Mm. So they were fresh and you could train them. And there's class of 30 11-year-olds. And I got every one of them to make a lino cut,
right,
using a sharp tool, and I didn't have any accidents, and every single one of them produced a print.
Right.
I was thrilled to bits. I actually adored it. But then, what happened? I was one art teacher, and there's a head art teacher. Mm. He left. So I said to the headmaster, well, I think I ought to be made up to head artist, because I'm the only art teacher here, and he didn't like that at all. So sure, when I left, he gave me a really crappy
reference.
Right. I never got back into teaching. Though I did go to teacher's training college for a while,
right,
but I never finished that because of domestic problems of my own creation. Nobody to blame but myself for that.
So how did you end up going freelance? That's one thing I haven't asked.
Well, let me think. I ran away to London and got various odd jobs, silly jobs.
Mm.
I put together some sort of folder and applied art agencies and got a job, finally, in a small agency in London whose main source of income was doing the pools adverts,
right,
once a week, which had to be done really quickly and professionally. So that was all right. While I was there, a freelance artist used to come in and use some of our facilities.
Mm.
And I used to do some work for him via the studio, which he got charged for at the rates which they set. So he suggested to me that if I went freelance, he would still give me lots of work,
mm,
but I would charge him less than the studio did, and I'd be better off anyway. So that seemed like a good idea. So I went freelance, went to work for him, and worked for a couple of months, I guess. And then he went on holiday, so I was left in charge. And I was doing all the work. And when he came back, I gave him a bill for all the work I did. Yeah. And he was horrified at how much it was. So he went out and hired another assistant and stopped giving me any work. And that was when I really became freelance and started traipsing around with the intention of becoming an illustrator.
Right.
Joined an agency. Who got me some work for advertising stuff and some couple of magazine things, but I never got really. They were a bit miffed with me because I wouldn't give them all my work because I was doing stuff for comics. I thought, well, I've got that work, so I'm not going to pay you a percentage of the work I got for myself.
Mm.
So we fell out as well. Eventually, I was earning enough from comics to be able to stay on my own.
Mm. It's something that's really struck me about having chatted to people like Ron Smith, John Cooper, over the years, is how many artists used to have agents and how few now have. Like it's almost unheard of amongst the art community to have an actual agent who gets you work, as opposed to an agent who organises the work that you've got, kind of thing. But it used to be the thing.
Yeah, everybody had an agent.
Yeah. I was particularly taken with Kelvin's story about one artist that they never met. The agent used to bring the artwork in every week, and so they all suspected that the agent was actually the artist, and it was some kind of tax swindle, which I quite enjoyed. One thing that has kind of trundled on over the years is whether or not Button Man is going to be made into a TV show or a movie.
Well, the latest information. Let me think. DreamWorks collapsed.
Mm.
It was then John and I sold the option to an agent who passed it on to Warner Brothers TV, who, with the aid of Bad Robot, were going to make a TV series. Mm. That was 2 years ago. That option's run out, but Warner Brothers have asked to renew it for another year. So John and I, having asked for more money than they originally offered, and also insisted that we get credit at the beginning of the movie and not at the end, which is what they planned to do.
Sure.
They agreed to that. So now we're waiting for the contracts to turn up.
Right.
And that's that for another year. But I'm not hopeful.
I do like John's line, which is he's made more money out of Button Man from it never being made than he ever will from it actually appearing, just from the options being renewed every year, which is quite something. I mean, if it were to happen,
we'd be rich and famous.
Rich and famous, yeah. Would you have any hopes about how it would? Would you prefer it to be ultra faithful to
the
comic? Yeah,
I think I think it's very unlikely, but I would like them to start in Britain and then take him to America the way we did,
right?
And the stick as close. I mean, as you said, it's practically a storyboard anyway.
Yeah,
but I'd be very amazed if that happens.
Mm.
It may not even be called Button Man. They might just take the idea of people shooting each other for cash and run with that.
Right.
I have no hopes for the film at all.
It's interesting seeing whenever we post up something on Facebook or Twitter or whatever, there will always be somebody who will say, oh, that'd make a great movie, or that'd make a great TV show. Do you feel any sense of urgency or design to have stuff that you've worked on turned into TV or movies, or is it an added benefit?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's not something that would ever occur to me when I was drawing the thing. May as well to make a great... Someone actually asked about that. Some filmmaker asked about me, but then we never heard from him again.
Mm.
But that could be a great movie, couldn't it? If they can do Game of Thrones, they could do Maxwell.
Yeah, absolutely. No, they just have to... what's the...
I mean, it won't happen, but, but we can dream.
I love with Maxwell the whole kind of feel of, you know, Penrose Stairs, the eternal staircase. I just love the idea that you walk through Maxwell and it doesn't necessarily, even though it's a maze, there's no actual way to solve the maze. You just keep walking through it eternally. So you have a civilization built on the fact that it's always built up of the same thing, just repeating itself over and over again. One thing I did want to ask you about Maxwell, the motif of the eternal, the original maze, you know, the old prehistoric branch maze.
The labyrinth.
Yes, yeah. That's a kind of recurring thing. Was that you just...
That's just a basic...
Just a basic one, labyrinth,
right? Thing. Yeah, I mean, I must have got lots of books on mazes. I think it sounds like the sort of thing I would do.
Okay, it's like, you know, these days you can just Google that stuff, but...
Yeah, but I mean, I guess you could make a maze any way you like, but for it to be, there's certain rules, I believe, about mazes. I mean, they can't just be, I mean, because there's the other thing called a meander, which is not a maze, but just somewhere where it leads you nowhere at all, you just wander about it. And the labyrinth is different. The labyrinth is not a maze.
Mm.
It's just a difficult walk.
Because one of the things I like about Maze World is that it merges all these different
I use all of them. Yeah.
Because to a certain extent, it kind of reminds me, the whole thing about reference reminds me of when they used to send Massimo Ballardinelli pages torn out of sort of nature books to say, make your monster look like this. Whereas now you could just, you know, quick bit online and you'd have all your reference. I mean, that probably would have made the whole process a little bit quicker. Two final questions and then I'll stop the torture. You've already mentioned the Society for Strip Illustration, which was... one of the founders of that was Dennis Gifford, the comics historian. What was your involvement in the SSI?
Well, I mean, initially I just went along. You know, it seemed like a good idea.
Mm.
I did finish up as chairman.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because the chairman before me was Martin. The artist from Looking. Never mind. But I thought we made such a bad job of it. I got irritable and said, I thought I would do it. So, and the year I was chairman, we organised a really terrific Comic Con with all sorts of guests from all over from America and from Europe.
Mm.
It was a huge success. But then next year, little or nothing, I think it kind of... At the end of the year, I had some guy, he wasn't an artist, he was a associate member.
Mm.
And he worked his socks off for me, organising all sorts of stuff to make this conference come off. And right at the end, he came in and he said, shall I tidy the chairs away? And I felt so depressed. This poor guy was just hadn't lost the ability to make any decisions for himself, because I'd been telling him what to do for the past year. And I thought, sod this, I don't want this responsibility. so I kind of gave up being chairman.
I like that. Brilliant. Final question, and I always ask this one. Looking back on the past 40 odd years at your career, at the work you've produced, the way things have panned out, working at Looking, working at 2000 AD, how do you feel about that? What's your perspective on it now? Are you happy with it? Are there things you would have done differently?
I'm sure there is. There always are. But there's no undo last.
Oh yeah, control Z, yeah.
No, I mean, looking at it as a package, I think it's, yeah, no, I'm really satisfied with it. It's, I feel quite proud of it. I mean, it's the sort of thing that makes you feel more famish than famous, if you know what I mean. But it's quite nice.
Have you appreciated people's appreciation of your work?
No. I'm incapable of accepting a compliment. One of the things I discovered when I was doing counselling training, right, it's very hard for me to accept a compliment. I mean, all you do is say thank you, but I find it much easier to make some, you know, slight remark, talk about something else. One thing I did read about based on my work, which I really liked, and I wish I could tell you the woman's name, someone's done a blog post analysing a couple of pages from May's World. And people so rarely do that. They don't, and you know, she was talking about how the page works. I thought that was terrific. I enjoyed that. But mostly, I don't take compliments seriously or well. It's a failing of mine.
You've kind of touched on this already. Do you feel fortunate that your career alighted on a particular period where you had something like Looking that was stable and kept going for a long period of time, and then it was an easy transition to 2000 AD, yeah, which has continued going?
No, if you were a time traveller planning to be a comic strip artist and you choose which, I mean, yeah, my time would just be about perfect, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Wouldn't it?
Yeah. And one very, 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 very final question, I promise. And this is partly a kind of humble brag for the podcast. One of the inadvertently most influential pages you've done was the map page.
Yes, that's funny, isn't it?
Yeah. Which
your wife bought for you for your birthday.
Yeah, and now adorns my wall. Thank you very much. Because what I find interesting about that is how it's the kind of thing where, I mean, I believe you said you just did. It says, you know, a map of the world. And so you make this little map with all these details, not thinking it will have any
impact. Yeah, no, they took it up and they've used it ever since, haven't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. Perhaps I should ask for a copyright.
Well, it's something like that because, the physical item has like four acetates over the top with the different elements on. So with the text on, of the map and everything. That kind of thing, based on what we've said about your experience of design and illustration, that kind of thing's just second nature because it looks like technical drawing almost.
Well, yeah, no, all that was done in... at the office,
right?
Not by all those overlays. I wouldn't have put overlays.
Oh, right. Okay. So what you just drew the world.
Yeah.
Filled in a couple of things, and then they
added stuff to it.
Right.
Yeah. So they can take some credit for that as well.
Because what I love about that page is you've got there's long painted panels at the top, showing the web that's breaking in sort of the other world kind of thing. And then you've got this very straightforward, very technical, very factual map. That's a wonderful contrast between those two things. With something like that, is that the kind of thing you would just take in your stride? You just go, oh, well, I need to do a map now.
Well, I assume Alan asked for a map.
Right.
If he must have done, I wouldn't. No, I don't think I would have put a map in.
No. What I mean is, you know, the script says there's a map of the world. It's got these elements.
Yeah. So if I mean, and I chose to use the, I forget what the projection is called, the mercurial projection. Or something, as opposed to the regular one.
Mm.
Because it's more, at that time, it was more politically correct. Because it shows worlds, the spaces, and how they actually compare.
Mm.
Whereas the map that's usually used makes Europe look much bigger than it actually is.
It's funny that, isn't it? It's almost as if that's a conscious choice. Yeah. That's it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
That was you've been very generous with your time.
I can't really thank Arthur enough for taking so much time to chat about his life and his work. I hope you've enjoyed it, Earthlitz. It's been a rare pleasure to chat to one of my favourite all-time artists. And, some really great stories. And it was amazing to just sit down and share a cup of tea and a biscuit. Tune in 2 weeks' time, where we're going to be talking to some of the creators behind this year's Free Comic Book Day issue from 2000 AD. And in a month's time, we're going to be talking to Mark Russell, who's the writer on IDW's new Judge Dredd series. Tune in on iTunes, your favourite podcast app, or online at 2000AD.com/podcast. Until next time, Earthlitz, Splendid Verthrig.
Fell power levels dangerously high. Alert! Alert! Read 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the galaxy's greatest comic at 2000adonline.com. Subscribe digitally on our apps for Apple, Android, and Windows 10. And download DRM free copies from 2000adonline.com. Alert! Alert! Stand by for urgent updates. Search for 2000 AD on Twitter and Facebook. Watch the latest videos at youtube.com/2000ADonline and follow on Instagram at Insta2000AD. Program complete. Shutting down.